Welcome to In Conversation with David Goa. Since November 11, 1931, Canadians have paused to remember those men and women who have served in our various armed forces. Shortly after attending this year's service of memory in Ottawa, I sat down with Lorraine Smith MacDonald to think about her work listening to soldiers who had recently served in Canada's forces in Afghanistan and elsewhere. How has she come to prepare for this work? And what has she drawn from it that we all need to understand? As a child, Lorraine sat on her uncle's knee, watching the television series MASH and eating vanilla ice cream flavored with creme de menthe. Her parents, one Scottish Presbyterian and one Irish Catholic, regularly invited their respected clergy over for dinner and hospitable conversation across religious lines. Not surprising, she grew up with an interest in the depth of the Christian spiritual tradition. She studied philosophy and ethics at Dominican College University in Ottawa. It was here that the depth of Christian thinking about the spiritual life was opened to her. Building on her initial intellectual formation, she went on to do her master and doctorate degrees with a research program on trauma and healing, on moral injury, the undoing of one's sense of character, on guilt and forgiveness, on being both a victim and a victimizer. Since the common psychiatric model has been largely ineffective with returning soldiers, she has worked at finding the healing waters that spring from the continuous work on the spiritual life at the heart of Christian understanding. Welcome to our conversation. So, Lorraine.
Yes.
Tell me again this lovely story about a man that you appreciate and you noticed on my bookshelf when you walked in, Joseph Pieper.
I was introduced to Joseph Pieper probably about, at least 10, 15 years ago. And the book that I read was his essay on hope, which he wrote in 1934, I believe, just at the rise of Nazism, because he believed that people had lost hope. And his great fear, of course, was that in the process of falling to despair, that people would then turn to their political leaders to provide that hope, which, of course, we know happened. So years later, when I was in doing my Master's of Divinity in the seminary, I was fortunate to be able to reread a lot of Pieper's work. And I presented to the class, I can't remember on which of his many books and essays, but there's this lovely story that I think, you know, really strikes and seems very fitting for today, which is November 11th, which is he was, of course, required to join the German army by force, as many people were at that time. And there's a story, whether it's true or not, I can't say, but at least in the writings that I read, that he recognized there was a danger in being forced into the German army, that he could lose himself in his faith. And so the story goes that he carried around a little pocket version of, if you can carry a pocket version, I'm not sure what that looks like, of St. Thomas's Summa Theologica. And that whenever he was faced with a moral or ethical situation, which you can imagine, being a soldier in Germany at the time, he probably faced many, that he would, before he carried out the order, he would stop and he would be what he thought, passage that he thought would be appropriate, and sort of check that order against, you know, in some ways, what would St. Thomas Aquinas do kind of approach. And I just, it will always stay with me. I think it's just an unbelievably powerful image of this man in the midst of, you know, the world really being on fire. He was living out his faith in that moment. And of course that caused conflict and you know, he was almost shot numerous times as being a German traitor to the military by not necessarily following orders. But I think it's just a really beautiful story.
And it's an example of a person who
has this deep sense that whatever your current circumstances, whatever the historical experience that is unfolding before you, whatever that is, bringing it into conversation with the great religious tradition, in his case of Christianity, was a way of trying to get some balance, a way of trying to find your way through, a way of lending to everything a kind of human proportion, even if it's the terror of history.
Absolutely.
So, and the one thing that's struck me about you when we first met and talked, and then more recently, and was a delightful surprise, is to learn that you as well have, in your education, came to study the great tradition and to bring it to bear, and then to make some vocational choices. Not the least of which we remember today, which is engaging in the Canadian military. So can you tell me just a little bit about your early formation and your time at studying with the Catholic Order?
Yeah, so I was going to say that I would start to talk about my Master's of Divinity, but I actually think it was before that, and, you know, depending on how Freudian we want to go, we could even go before that and talk quite a bit about, you know, being raised. I was raised in a, you know, by two parents who were both very devout. My father was Scottish Presbyterian, and my mother was Irish Catholic, so you can imagine that that caused some heated discussions around the dinner table. But both very committed to their faith, to their faith traditions, and for the most part, outside of, you know, a few moments, I think pretty committed. So I have some lovely memories of growing up. Once a month, my mom would invite her Catholic priests, and my dad would invite his minister over for dinner, and they would have dinner at our house, which, again, revealing my age here, you know, 35, almost 35 years ago, was a big deal at the time.
And they would come together?
The two clergy would come over for dinner, and we would have dinner as a family with both ministers. And then, you know, usually the kids would be allowed to go play, but then usually it was an opportunity for theological dialogue between sort of both sides and community. We grew up in a small town, so it was kind of a lovely memory.
Where was that?
Back home in Ontario. So north of Toronto, which now, if you go there, you wouldn't even recognize it. It's, I took my husband home, and he was like, "Are you sure this is your hometown?" Because it's now million-dollar estates, and growing up, it was just a small farming community. You know, the typical kind of places you would you would grow up in. So, but anyways, let's not stay too long in the family stories. But, you know, I think I was definitely kind of influenced by that. And then I was very fortunate that after kind of bouncing around for a little while, I finished my undergraduate degree and spent a good chunk of my undergraduate degree actually at the studying with the Dominicans, so at Dominican College University in Ottawa, which I absolutely adored. And I was incredibly blessed. I think I didn't even know how blessed I was to get that kind of education. So I studied philosophy and ethics, and absolutely loved it and have tremendous respect for the Dominicans. We weren't taught just by the Dominicans. There were civilian, sorry, you can tell my military, civilian, non-clergy, non-religious profs, and actually there was a good chunk of them. So I was able to be sort of taught by both. But I think even the professors who were non-religious, I think, really embodied that spirit. You know, it was just an incredible environment to learn in and to be able to be exposed. And you know, in true sort of fashion, you know, we studied original texts. And so, you know, for me, it's not just reading other people's views of all of these philosophers. It was really the opportunity, I think, to engage them. And I think that style of learning has always stuck with me, and I think that's where I would say my hunger came from, because even in reading those philosophical texts, you just regardless of whether you agree with them or not, or you know, buy into kind of the argument that they're putting forward, there's no denying that, you know, the great philosophical thinkers that we've had throughout the many centuries are extraordinary. And I think to be able to understand to the best of my ability, you know, the fountain of and depth of thought that we have in the world, I think was hugely eye-opening and tremendously powerful to recognize that.
And your appreciation of that grew, if I recall, from an earlier conversation we had when you went to graduate school.
It did.
And realized how different it was.
Yes. I think I was able to fortunately follow some of that into my Master's of Divinity, and I think then being more exposed to the rich Catholic tradition, myself being Roman Catholic, sadly, I actually would have enjoyed if we'd had more time to spend on the early, that is an area that I think I would advocate for in hindsight, you know, to have had the ability to take the time, and we sort of had scatterings of patristic thought throughout various courses, but I think to have really been able to sit deep and richly in their writings would have been, you know, that's my perhaps one complaint. But again, I think, you know, just being exposed to that, and I think in some ways of what my MDiv taught me was just how deep a well we have and how little in some ways we get, you know, as Catholics and lay people, and that probably sounds a bit judgmental, and I don't mean it in that way, but I think we just have this incredible richness. And so for myself to in many ways understand my own faith in a more deep way, and then, as you so beautifully put, David, to then be able to understand it in a way that then can be moved into the world and communicated. And it doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, I have all the answers or I completely understand something, but I think what it does give is a framework and a language, or at least some means by which to try and wrestle with those ideas, and to recognize, I think, you know, what is new is old, and vice versa. And so much of what we're struggling with has already been discussed and wrestled with. And again, it doesn't mean we have to, I don't want to fall into a type of nostalgia here, but to at least understand that is there, and it's a starting point, it's a launch pad for us to think about these issues.
My sense is that it helps you have a real feel, and I use that term advisedly, for the complexity of life.
Absolutely.
And of course, it also deepens your sense of wonder. And of course, I think the greatest virtue of the study of the great tradition is, at least for some, maybe not for me, it really does give one a real sense of humility and of human limitation. So you ended up doing your doctoral work and then also moving towards the military.
Yeah, I did. I had actually intended, so that, you know, I had intended, the whole reason that I, you know, ended up at Dominican and then doing a Master's of Divinity was to actually become a military chaplain. And
how did that get laid on your heart? Why that?
Well, again, going very far back, I would say, as I shared this actually in my PhD defense, that I blame much of where I am on my uncle. We used to go to my grandmother's house, you know, every couple of weeks. And when I was small, you know, I used to curl up on his lap and we would watch MASH together while eating vanilla ice cream and creme de menthe. So as I joked in my PhD defense, what parent doesn't want their 5-year-old, you know, drinking alcohol and singing the words to Suicide is Painless? You know, it's just a beautiful image. But truly, I think, you know, I don't know why my parents thought it would be appropriate to have a 4- and 5-year-old watch MASH. And to be honest, most of it kind of went over my head. But I can't deny I was deeply moved by it. you know, and I was deeply moved by the stories, and I think in many ways I always kind of knew that was something that I kind of wanted to do. So, you know, fast forward a number of years, and through a long kind of twisted story and some discernment, I actually had the opportunity when I was in my undergrad, believe it or not, to just do some civilian cadet work. So, you know, no way comparing this to true military service, but I was able to spend about 3 months, three and a half, 4 months over the summer at CFB Gagetown in Ormaqdo, New Brunswick in the summer of 2007. And at that time, most of the troops, it is a huge army facility, main training base, were deployed to Afghanistan, and had been there for a significant period of time. And the reason that I know that is because about four or five weeks before I finished my contract, the troops came home from Afghanistan. And I was just deeply moved by that experience and was deeply impressed by what it is that, you know, military chaplains had done. I had sort of at that point sort of discerned that I wanted to do something in ministry, but I wasn't quite sure. I was very pastorally oriented, very kind of outgoing. I didn't quite know if church ministry in the traditional sense would fit for me. I'm also lay and a woman and Catholic, so you kind of add all of those things together. And, you know, I didn't just want to teach Sunday school. I wanted to do more than that. And I was just really, really moved by the work that military chaplains do and the issues they have to work with and wrestle with. And I just straight up loved it, to be totally honest. And so I took a turn to the left and changed my program and ended up at Dominican, and then went into a Master's of Divinity with that intention and applied and was accepted. And fortunately, for some health reasons, wasn't able to get in to, I wasn't able to pass the universal service requirement.
That to get into the military.
Yeah, to get into the military. So I was accepted to be a chaplain. I'm sure my file is still floating around somewhere in Ottawa. They're trying to figure out what to do with it. Because it was this really weird middle ground, kind of fell through the cracks, because I've been accepted into chaplaincy, which is its own stream and has its own recruitment process. But obviously, because you are a uniformed member, you also have to then pass military requirements, and just at the time that just wasn't feasible for me. And so I kind of found myself sort of going, okay, I'm not quite sure what I'm gonna do with myself. So I sort of did a whole bunch of other things, but I have to say, you know, I think that experience was always sort of on my heart, and I always kind of knew that that was something I was hugely interested in and very moved by. And I think so I ended up writing, even though I didn't end up serving, I wrote my Master's of Divinity thesis on the issue of guilt and forgiveness for soldiers, and really trying to sort of draw on a Hegelian dialectic of that. One of the challenges, based on what my colleagues and friends who were chaplains at the time serving were sharing, is that, you know, coming home from war, they knew something had happened to these people, that something very, on a very deep level, and they were sort of trying to figure that piece out. And so I wrote about, theoretically, just the issue that for many soldiers, one of the challenges is that they're both victim and victimizer all at the same time. And that when we, as from a Christian perspective, so I did write it from a Christological kind of framework, so we think about, you know, how do we, as chaplains and abroad in Christian sense, how do we address that? And how do we offer something that's meaningful? And again, going back to that deep richness, you know, I kind of looked at a lot of the forgiveness literature, and it seemed a little bit flat, a little bit kind of well-meaning, but not necessarily ontologically deep. And, you know, when you think about the types of challenges that our service members are confronted with, and that complexity, right? That, you know, how do you ask for forgiveness at the same point that you also may need forgiveness? You know, just this weird kind of interplay. And so the need to be more nuanced. I don't know if I ever came to any wonderful conclusion. And, you know, I look back on my thesis and think, goodness, it's not published. It's kind of a half-baked thought. But, you know, it's sort of the beginning of playing with those ideas and trying to think about that. And then after that, I was able to very fortunately do a second MA and then a PhD. And when I was in my PhD, they asked me, you know, the usual question, why are you here and what do you want to do? And I had toyed with a whole bunch of different ideas, but when I really thought about, you know, what did I really want to understand, what did I really want to do, I kind of wanted to go back to my MDiv work and try and make sense of it, but in this time, not necessarily from a theological or sort of theoretical framework, but actually from a health research perspective. So what is the impact of this on our service members, and how does this play out? You know, what is the consequence of these?
Guilt and forgiveness is a profound health issue, isn't it? I mean, even within the great religious tradition, it's understood that way.
Mm-hmm.
This all has to do with how do you become a healthy, integrated human being?
Yeah.
And in your particular case, with members of the military who have come through what must almost always be some form of trauma.
Mm-hmm.
It's a huge matter.
Mm-hmm.
So you then turned your attention to spending some time talking with members of the Canadian Armed Services after they had served, when they were back. This morning, listening to the Remembrance Day service in Ottawa, I heard a comment by one person who said, for soldiers, war never ends.
Mm.
You carry it with you the rest of your life. And I also was very moved by the Chaplain General's prayer. I don't know if this is the first time it's been done, but I had never heard it before, where he spent some time in his prayer helping all of us come into the presence of those who have served in the military, both those who lost their life, those for whom trauma is carried forward into their life, and also for those where the suffering has become so deep that they can no longer bear it. And so they leave this world. So your work is involved entering into conversation and thinking with a number of these people.
Mm-hmm.
What do you hear?
Oh, well, I think the first thing I just want to say is that, you know, I've been so humbled to be able to do this work, and I think I just want to honor that, you know, I'm a civilian, I've not gone to combat, and so, you know, the things I say are things that have been shared with me, and so I just want to honor the source and the root of the people who have been so courageous in sharing what they have to say with me. So just put that out there first. So yeah, what have I heard? Oh my goodness. I've heard so many things, you know. So many things is actually even hard to, you know, try and group them together. I think the main thing that I heard, so just to put a context to it, in my doctoral work, my goal was to interview Canadian service members Canadian combat veterans who had been deployed in some capacity, and to understand really simply what was most injurious to them, you know, where
most
injurious, what was most injurious. harmful to them, you know, and the motivation for that was that obviously when we think about the health literature and the models that we use, they're very medically oriented, and I think that shouldn't be shunned. It shouldn't be underestimated. You know, tremendous work has been done, predominantly driven by actually the American Armed Forces, when we think about, you know, even the creation of the diagnosis of PTSD, you know, is very much driven by Vietnam, right? And so we owe that to Vietnam soldiers, as horrific as that was. I mean, our understanding of PTSD as a psychiatric illness and the suffering and the harm that comes from it has been driven by that for everyone. You know, every civilian who has a PTSD diagnosis has that diagnosis because of effectively Vietnam's soldiers. It wasn't just them. We know that diagnosis was also influenced by rape survivors. And so I don't want to seem like it was only, but certainly the power of the American military is quite large, and certainly their advocacy for some sort of diagnosis was large and powerful.
So it's interesting to me that it comes out of the Vietnam War, because part of what the Vietnam War shares with rape victims is that when they came home, many of them were persona non grata.
Yes.
That is, the meaning of their suffering.
Yes.
Was not held.
No.
By the community at all.
No. If not shunned and belittled and other things. Absolutely. You know, I can't remember. There's a quote that stays with me. I don't even remember from which book. I've read many books at this point. But, you know, they were interviewing a Vietnam veteran, and he actually compared himself to a rape victim. He said, America was like the mother who sold her daughter out to her rapist boyfriend. You know, that idea that, you know, we were left to suffer with no one to say, let me hold your suffering, let me offer you a way to understand this, or let me be there with you in this. Sorry, tangent. Let me go back. So that was my goal of my PhD work. And the reason for that is, in between my Master's of Divinity and getting to my PhD, there had been some real discussion about this idea of a construct called moral injury. So, and actually, interestingly, you know, sort of how these things come together. The first person who sort of coined the term moral injury was Dr. Jonathan Shea, who was a psychiatrist who worked very heavily with actually Vietnam veterans, some of the most severe Vietnam veterans who were in residential programs down in the States in the VA. And his concept was that he noticed that although he was working incredibly hard to treat their PTSD and psychiatric symptoms, he noticed that there was something deeper that had happened to these people. And so he called it, in his book, like the undoing of character, that somehow what these men, especially, because that was predominantly who he worked with, had been undone. Their humanity, their selfhood, their character, as he would call it, had been undone. And so, interestingly, not much happened. So when I was doing my Master's of Divinity work, you know, there was a few scattered articles, a lot of theological discussions about this idea, guilt, forgiveness, you know, shame, you know, kind of what happens to people's souls. There was a lot of that kind of language, but not a lot of discussion in terms of the larger mental health literature about how this may play into kind of mental health challenges that service members and veterans face. And then interestingly, in the 2010s, there was this massive explosion of this construct called moral injury. And this was sort of the term that kind of got put around these ideas, and henceforth has really exploded in the literature, which is quite lovely to see. And there was just this whole interest of, well, what happens to people, and how does that then play out in terms of their health and well-being? So their psychological, their emotional, their psychosocial, relational, familial, and I would say their spiritual. And so when I was thinking about this whole question, and when I was going back, I was really curious, and I thought, well, before we start to say, okay, PTSD matters and moral injury matters, why don't we just take a step back and just interview veterans themselves and ask them, what matters to you? You know, kind of, where are you most wounded? What sticks with you? Where are you getting stuck? Like, where are we struggling to necessarily give you the care not only the care that you deserve, but also the results. Because we know traditionally veterans have done more poorly in gold standard psychotherapeutic interventions, which is quite interesting across the board. So, you know, you can give a civilian something like prolonged exposure therapy or CPT, so cognitive processing therapy, EMDR, and they tend to do better en masse than veterans. Veterans always seem to sort of struggle to necessarily reach the same therapeutic effect, which is quite interesting. So, you know, there was a sort of curiosity for me, like, are we missing something?
I heard one little snippet of interview this morning from Ottawa where the person said, was referring to his father, and said that for Remembrance Day, this is not a day my father looks forward to.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not remembering.
Mm-hmm.
It's experience.
Yeah, it's reliving.
He's living it.
Yeah, he's living
it. Again and again.
Yeah. And I think we can't lose sight of that in any kind of way. The power of trauma and how it stays in the psyche. So when I did those interviews, really what came out of those interviews and came out of my research was that when I asked veterans, you know, kind of what really wounded you, where are you most stuck still, what harmed you, it was incredibly surprising to me, because what they shared with me is, albeit the things that we would think would be most traumatic certainly had an impact, you know, the guns, the bullets, the bombs, the blowing up, the gruesome sights. What really stuck with them, and this is my word, not theirs, they use many different words to describe this, but essentially were those morally injurious experiences. The experiences in which they could no longer reconcile what was, or what was with who they were, or what was with what they wanted or wished. And those stories, as I was interviewing them, you could see were very much raw and real and very much there. And it was profoundly humbling.
So is this a kind of fissure between the action that was required of them, the relationships that they treasured perhaps, and a fissure between that and their being itself?
I think so. And I think I just want to clarify too that it wasn't always things they had to do. You know, it's interesting, and I think from a civilian perspective, I think it's hard for us to think that most soldiers are actually really okay with killing. It's not, it's traumatic. And when I say okay with it, I don't mean they love it or they enjoy it. But, you know, killing an enemy combatant, I think they recognize that there's an element of that's part of who they are. So it's not always necessarily actions per se. But it was also in stories of inactions. Their hands are tied, rules of engagement, you know. A lot of the times it was things around not being able to help women and children, being, you know, totally helpless in the face of civilians. It was also questions, I think, of, you know, what we would call theodicy, you know, questions of good and evil. You know, I think you can't go to and see some of the things that they've seen or experience some of the things that they've experienced and not be unbelievably moved, you know. And some of the stories that have been shared with me, I carry too, you know. One gentleman shared with me, he was in he was a peacekeeper deployed shortly after the Khmer Rouge had been removed, and they were going around in the communities to try and you know, deal with issues of, you know, genocide and mass graves and to try and create some stability, and they came across a, I don't know what it is. The point of the story is that they came across this building, and they found inside just thousands of bodies. But not only were there bodies, someone had actually arranged the skulls into a picture. And he said, you know, I was in the process of working with him. He said, you know, how do I make sense of that? Right? You know, it wasn't just that they killed, you know, women and indiscriminately women and children, you know, and civilians and in masses that you can't even comprehend, but then that they would desecrate what he saw to be desecration of the bodies, that someone could sit there and pick out skulls and organize them into an artistic mosaic pattern. And he showed me a picture of, because I had taken pictures for the UN, so he had, for the UN and for the War Crimes Tribunal. And so he showed me a picture of what it looked like. And I don't know. What do I say to that, you know? So I often think mixed in to so many of those traumatic experiences are, for many service members, this deep-rooted pain and suffering of the human experience on steroids is probably the best way that I could put it, you know, that I think we all have those moments of horror and moments of struggle with, and this is my theology coming out here, but I don't know of a better word, of the evil that, you know, can be in the world, you know, that people can do just unbelievable things to people.
We are all the witness of our own life.
Yeah.
Our own experience. That phrase, you know, in the prayer that Jesus Christ taught us to pray, deliver us from evil.
Yeah.
It takes on a whole meaning as you speak. I recall many years ago having a conversation with an older graduate student from Toronto who was working through diaries from the First World War, the diaries of chaplains. Mm. And he had a problem that he was trying to think through. So he told me that as he'd worked on a particular set of chaplains that had served in the First World War, a number of them were Methodist, and another batch were Presbyterians, and that he had studied their lives a little bit and read through their diaries, looked at what happened to them after they came back from the war, and he had noted that a number of the Methodist chaplains that came back, a noticeable number of them, had left the church, had, in a sense, stepped out of the Christian tradition. And he was struggling to understand what this was. Mm. And in the course of our discussion, I suggested that maybe this has something to do with that whole matter of theodicy. Mm-hmm. I love the Methodist Church. And, you know, the Presbyterian Church is nothing to fool with either. I mean, both of them have their real genius. But the Methodist Church and the whole holiness movement, I think it's fair to say, and actually I've talked with him somewhat later on when he had concluded his work, and this is one of the decisions that one of the conclusions he came to, is that the toughness of Calvinist theology around the question of evil seemed to him to make it, I don't quite know what word to use for this, to make it possible for the Presbyterians to live with it, to live with the evil. Mm. Whereas the Methodists and their rich sense of the love and friendship of God, that their, if you will, their theology of evil was too small to help them integrate this experience.
I think so. I think I have so much humility, you know, since I've done this work. Sometimes I show it, sometimes I'm not so great about it, but, you know, God always keeps me on my toes on that virtue vice pairing. But genuinely, you know, I've been so humbled since being able to do this work, and the reason for that is because I look and hear and to a small way experience some of the stories that people share with me, and I really have come to see how small the box that we gave them was, you know, that and that box is my box, you know, when I you know, this whole idea of, you know, guilt and forgiveness, you know, I think of my own life and my own struggles to forgive. You know, I'm Irish Catholic. We're big on the guilt, not so big on the forgiveness side.
You're very good on the guilt.
Yeah, we're excellent. We're excellent on the guilt.
But some of us think you've got a lot to be guilty for.
Oh my goodness. you know, and my own struggles to forgive small, petty, you know, just unbelievably tiny, 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 tiny things, you know, and then how dare I try to say to someone who has witnessed just unbelievable horror and evil, you know, and in some ways, you know, I need you to forgive that. And when I say forgive that, I don't mean in the modern sense of, you know, justifying, coating over, carpeting, you know, all of those things. I mean, in the sense of you need to let go of that so that your heart can find freedom in this experience. We need to help you work through this so that you can come to a sense of peace. That's what I mean by forgiveness. And I mean, it's mind kind of blowing in some ways to think of the vastness of the size and the scope and the scale. And I think in some ways this is a struggle of our modern society. And I think the second piece that veterans shared with me in terms of what was most harmful and difficult for them was what they called, or again, what I called a failed military to civilian transition. So that transition to try and go back to civilian life. And I wonder, and this is just my own opinion here, if part of that is because we have also failed to help them to integrate. And part of that integration, I think, is both ways. It's not just that military members need to reintegrate into civilian life, but I think we as civilians need to integrate more into military life. And for me, I think the heart of that isn't necessarily that we all need to, you know, wear uniforms and polish our boots and you know, kind of surface level things. But what I mean by that is we need to enter into that space with them and to recognize that our experience in the Western world is not the experience of large parts of the world. And so when we send our soldiers overseas to do these missions, often peacekeeping missions too, like let's not lose sight of that. Albeit there's a whole conversation around, you know, what does that mean? But, you know, we send them overseas to see and to live with and to try and address some just tremendously complex issues, and then they come home.
And that our society has been complicit. This isn't about blaming, it's just a description. Mm-hmm. In the creation, there's a kind of co-creation of all these traumas around the world. And so the notion that we have not, as civilians, taken our responsibility for the depth of, for the place that military service has within our world and within our society. Mm-hmm. And that is part of us. It's not separate from us. Mm-hmm. It's part of us as well. And that's thinned a lot. I know it's thinned with my generation.
Yeah, I would say it's thinned with mine too. And I think it's also thinned for me speaking as a Christian, I think it's also thinned tremendously with our Christian community. That if there was somewhere, perhaps, that could provide support and guidance. And for many military members, you know, they're so turned off religion, having gone to some of these places, you know. And I can understand that, you know, if you've seen religion being wielded as a tool of violence and death, then it's very difficult. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to think about God as an all-loving mm-hmm. God. You know, how does that all go together?
So you said that the church is a factor here. Mm. Is it, what immediately comes to my mind, Lorraine, you know, I'm in some sense a child of the Vietnam War, because I was in the United States during that period, and it was a struggle for me. And in many ways, my generation, as well as the church prior to my generation, there has certainly been a heightened sense of critique of war, a expanding of notions that that we should never be in that position. And there is, in my generation, a lot of utopian thought about how history unfolds. So I was wondering, when you said this issue, when you hinted at it, are you suggesting that within our churches there's been a shift? Maybe there's necessity in it. I'm not arguing that in any way, but so that within the discourse of the church, whether it's within preaching or prayer or what have you, teaching, that it hasn't had a large enough sense of our responsibility, the fact that the military is part of our society. And our society is the holder of the military, and that to separate it as if it isn't a part of our life, to not have a language which is large enough to hold it, in a kind of daily way. I mean, it is Remembrance Day. We do some things on Remembrance Day. Mm-hmm. But I often think we do them in order to isolate them. Let's deal with that on November 11th, and then we can move on with the rest of our life. Are you suggesting that within the church itself, there's been a thinning of its discourse, its language, around this dimension of human life, which has been ubiquitous for human beings? How do you understand it?
Yeah, I think yes and no. I think my comment was actually more in terms of your latter point, which is that I think there has been a thinning of our language of the human experience. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think, you know, I'm cognizant that I think we could have a whole conversation about, you know, just war theory and, you know, does that fit anymore and how does that all go together and so on. But I think I would say yes to your point in the sense of the military is part of our society. But I would say deeper than that, and actually I think for many soldiers, the need is not, as I said, isn't necessarily to, you know, you have to understand my military service, but for people who have been wounded by their military service, wounded by the traumas, wounded by their morally injurious experiences, I would say especially, we have struggled as a society and as a people, as a human people. We have lost the ability to talk about that. And I think, you know, to go full circle, perhaps this is why I'm so deeply moved by, you know, these early thinkers, because they understand the complexity of the human experience and have tried to find ways to discuss that, to discuss those things. And, you know, going back to my half-baked thesis, you know, in my MDiv, I don't think it helps people to minimize, to try and wrap up in a bow something that is horrific.
Is it also not the fact that we have given a lot of attention to a kind of theology about just war or what have you, and not anything like as rich attention to the spiritual life of human beings?
Yeah.
And in the ancient church, everybody suffered. Everybody knew what that was about. Mm-hmm. It was part of the daily diet.
Yeah.
Because, first of all, they lived with far less technological intervention
mm-hmm.
between them and nature.
Mm-hmm.
The issues of war and sacrifice were normal.
Yeah.
I'm not idealizing it. I'm only saying that within the experience of the men and women that thought about these things in the Christian church, they weren't thinking about it theologically in mm-hmm. the abstract in order to justify this position or that position. They were grappling with the human experience of passion, suffering, death. And their thinking is about the spiritual life.
Yeah.
And that's where it strikes me your work has been as well.
Mm-hmm.
Listening is thinking about the spiritual life.
Mm-hmm.
And what is that dimension of the injury,
mm-hmm.
which, as the doctor you mentioned at the beginning pointed out, is in some sense beyond the reach mm-hmm. of even our normal psychological disciplines.
Yeah.
They're spiritual in nature.
Mm-hmm. And I think
they're about integration or disintegration. Integration.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I think that with that language, I can't speak for all veterans, and I'm not claimed, as I said, to be one here, but I think that language of integration versus integration, I think would very much fit for them, that the language of, you know, the words they use are, you know, broken, and like they know they can't quite put themselves back together again, you know, that there's been this rupture, this fission, this disintegration
mm-hmm.
of who they are in some ways, and that they can't go back. They can't go back to who they were. You know, one gentleman called it, you know, he was sort of trying to describe it to me, and I just said to him, is it, kind of sounds like a death of self. And he said, yeah, that's exactly. It's death of self.
And suicide has become quite common.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I recall you mentioning that the issue of suicide is there
mm-hmm.
in the common discourse that occurs between people involved in the military.
Mm-hmm. It is. And it's tragic in the truest theological sense of that. I have a colleague, a good colleague and a friend and colleague in the States who was funded to look at the issue of suicide with veterans in the United States, and just trying to even make sense of the numbers and also then trying to get a sense of, you know, who were these people and where were they and some of the community contextual factors. So trying to get a better sense, because, you know, we've struggled from a research and perspective to know, you know, what's protective per se and what's more of a risk factor. You know, there's some general things, but, you know, even that, the data is quite conflicting at times. So, you know, some data has shown things like, you know, having a mental illness, so PTSD or depression, can lead you to be at a higher risk for suicide. Some data has shown that's not completely true, or at least it's conflicting. I would say the biggest thing to take, the takeaway message here, is just that data on suicides with veteran and military personnel is conflicting. We're struggling to know. And so his work is called Operation Deep Dive, and it's been very interesting to hear some of his discussion on that. And, you know, one of the pieces we've talked about is that where suicide and mental health interact, there's also an element of where suicide and spirituality interact. Mm-hmm. And for me, thinking about some of the stories that I've heard, you feel the weight, the weightiness of the despair that often can come from those experiences. And again, when I think of what despair means, despair as hopelessness, you know, that it, you know, it is finished, but in a negative sense, you know, not, mm-hmm. not completion as triumph, but finality as an end point, that there is nothing else to it. You could perhaps understand why for some, that the suffering becomes overwhelming. And that suffering, I think, can also become overwhelming when it lacks meaning.
And meaning, of course, is never something you have as an individual. Mm-hmm. Meaning is what exists between us. Mm-hmm. And what exists between us and that which is transcendent. That's why it's so striking to me to think about PTSD and the Vietnam War, rape victims, the loss of the kind of compassionate, intimate relationships which can hold profound disease.
Yeah.
And the best that can be done is helping people understand the solidarity mm-hmm. of the human family around this sort of thing, and that's gone on through generations and centuries. But in our society, we have a habit of wanting to hide these things off mm-hmm. and medicalize them and not appreciate and draw forth just there is a genius in the Christian tradition and its understanding of the spiritual life, not of being able to resolve these things mm-hmm. or quote over them in any way, but to hold them, mm-hmm. to say yes. So the words of Jesus Christ from the cross, which have always struck me so deeply, you know, when he says, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? The center of the Christian thought about the passion is the fact that this could happen to the self.
Yeah.
It happens to Jesus Christ, for Christ's sake.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Look at it. What's he saying?
Yeah.
So part of the revelation of the passion is about that phenomena, that unbelievable fissure in being that can at least appear to arise. It happens to the God-man.
Yeah.
And then there's the last word from the cross, of course. Into thy hands I commend my spirit. So how, you know, to be with people mm-hmm. so that second last word can be held there. Mm-hmm. And maybe, just maybe, together we can say that final word. And maybe, just maybe, they can live for another day. Mm-hmm. Well, bless you in your work.
Thank you.
And your thinking.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. War never ends for those who serve. The moral injury is all too easily carried forward into civilian life and the future. And how do those of us who have not served in the armed forces reckon with our place as Canadian citizens in the suffering and trauma that has taken on a moral injury, that has been driven deep into the being of those who went on behalf of our collective decisions. I welcome your comments on the various themes in this podcast and invite you to visit our website. Contact details may be found in the program notes.